Up next on episode 58 of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss HTML encoding, designing safe by default, whether a question can be too simple, and the art of beta testing. From IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley. Today I'm excited to bring you another great program from Stack Overflow with Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood here on IT Conversations.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Stack Overflow.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited Windows 7 is getting traction because I want people to get off Windows XP. It's ridiculously old at this point.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm sorry, Vista was just unacceptable.
I know. We covered that on, I think, podcast number one, actually.
So I'm here in the brave new world of like Glass and Arrow and all that kind of, whoa. If you take a window and shake it, all the other windows disappear. Did you know that?
No.
In Windows 7, you grab a window by the title bar and shake it, and all other windows go away.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that happening. But I think I have to wait for the final, though, because I don't want to deal with release candidate stuff.
Okay, here's a question our listeners may know. I am thinking of doing this. Tell me what you think. Instead of, because all of my installation problems are always around Visual Studio, .NET Framework, and all that crap, I'm thinking of just making a VM that has, you know, VMware, a virtual machine that has Visual Studio installed in it. And that way I never have to deal with this BS again, ever.
You can do that. I've been advocating that for a while now. I think it depends. Yeah, sure. I think it depends, you know, how intensive your development environment is. I mean, if you're, like, for example, on Stack Overflow, one of the things that's kind of intensive for us is that we tend to work with copies of the production database, which is getting kind of chunky now, considering that the average backup for it is like 4 gigabytes with the SQL Server compression going. So, and just running that first query to get the database in memory, just the indexes and stuff, frequently times out on us now.
Oops.
So if you were doing that in a virtual machine, that would be kind of painful because it hit the disk really hard and stuff like that. But I think for your average, you know, start a Visual Studio project and compile it, which is largely CPU intensive, not so much disk, you should be okay. Because remember, you ran all those benchmarks. Remember when you're looking at solid state drives?
Sure. Yeah.
And it really depends how much disk is a bottleneck.
You can, if that really becomes the issue, you can always throw another hard drive in your computer and make it a dedicated hard drive for the VM.
Yes, yes. No, that's definitely the smart thing to do. I think what I'm getting at is if you want to do a lot of VM stuff, what you have to look at is disk I/O stuff because that's what tends to get really expensive.
Really slow, right.
More
right.
So than memory or CPU or stuff
Fair
like
enough.
That. But no, virtual machines are great, and I think certainly gives you
it's
tons
tempting.
Of portability.
If you think about what a Visual Studio development environment does, it's like it messes with IIS. It wants to install its own several versions of SQL Server, you know, in different places. Two or three. It wants to put in various versions of the .NET framework in various places. And that is just never like a happy thing. And, you know, and then it's just sort of spewing stuff all over the registry and not so you can find it either. It's all like under classes and then there are these GUIDs. So you're not going to be able to find what it has done to the registry that is causing your system to be screwy.
Yeah. No, I've had correspondence with developers that set up their machines this way. And certainly, I mean, we have just a ridiculous amount of power on the desktop.
Sure. Yeah. I got 8 gigs now and
Yeah. So why not try it out? Sure.
Okay. Okay. Speaking of databases, you promised me a copy of the Stack Overflow database without the data.
Yeah, we have that actually. We have the scripts that actually take everything out now. I just need to test that. So I actually have something on that. I just need to test it before.
I'm going to, for our listeners, what do you think about this name? StackExchange.com.
This
witty.
Is for so Joel's referring to the hosted version that of the Stack Overflow engine that Fog Creek is working on.
Right.
It's an okay name. I wonder if we can come up with something a little bit more punchy. Maybe people listening would have ideas, but we just want a name for the underlying Stack Overflow technology.
Yeah, Jason told us it was a knowledge exchange, which I nobody else uses that word, but what the hell, I like it. And so the product is a knowledge exchange server, I guess. And we want to allude at least to the original Stack Overflow. So the long version of the name might be something like the Stack Overflow Knowledge Exchange Server Hosted Edition. My Fall Creek product.
Right.
And
no, I like that name too. I think, you know, naming is very hard. We've had this discussion before. It's so hard. That's one of the reasons when, you know, super user came up, the idea that we could actually get super user, although it was a little expensive, to me was worth it just because I really like the name and it's, I don't have to think about it anymore, which is huge.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. 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 Some of the names, like I think one of the best names we ever picked for product was Copilot.
Right.
And I, you know,
Copilot's a good name.
Tyler so figured that out, but we had to have like a long brainstorming session before he came up with that one.
Yeah. So I think there might need to be a similar brainstorming session on the Stack Overflow hosted name. Because I do think having a reasonably good name is important. I don't think it has to be perfect, but having the wrong name is bad.
Some of these things like PHPBB, like the language in which it's implemented is 3/5 of the most important part of the name.
Well, yeah. And then like we've talked about like test-driven development has like possibly a completely misleading name.
Yeah, it serves them right.
Yeah, so yeah, the name, if you get the wrong name, that's kind of a big deal actually. Yeah. It doesn't have to be perfect, but just make sure it's not like really wrong or weird. That's probably what I'm thinking about. And Stack Exchange is close enough to that divide that I would want to think about it a little bit before proceeding. It's not horrible, but...
It's in the, you know, outside of New York City, and this is only outside of New York City, but anywhere else in the United States, there's a tendency of bagel stores to have cutesy names.
Oh, God.
it's either a bagel store or a store that sells sandwiches on bagels, and they always want to have, like, cute little names like, you know, something with a bagel in the name, or like there's one in the Hamptons called Twice Upon a Bagel. I don't even get that. Twice Upon a Bagel? What does that mean?
Well, the classic is like the Backstores. I think there's like a Seinfeld skit about this.
Backstores?
You know, the Lumbar Yard. You know, Backstores. So they sell back items.
Right.
And then also, of course, hair salons. So sure. Really punny. Really, really punny.
Bad
puns. You know, the main affair, things like that. So, yeah, you can get punny, which can get, you know, kind of unpleasant at some level.
Funny.
So yeah, if anyone listening has ideas on that or an opinion, we would definitely love to hear it. So Joel, actually, I have a something complimentary to say about you. I don't know if you'll remember this. This is a while ago, actually. Mm-hmm. But we were talking about storing values in the database that are ultimately displayed in HTML. And I mentioned that there were places where I was actually encoding things as HTML and then storing it in the database.
Right.
And you were like, no, that's horribly wrong.
Always wrong.
Yeah, that's always wrong. And I was like, no, I don't know if that's totally wrong. And now I got to tell you, you were totally right that was really wrong. Because, yes.
Take
because
a drink.
We were actually, I don't know why I thought this was a good idea in retrospect. It's one of those things where I go back and like, what was I thinking? Why would I do this? But stuff like the user's display name and actually the post title. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not large fields. These are not fields that it's particularly, you know, hugely important for them to be stored exactly the right way, but it ends up being really inconvenient when stuff is encoded in the database. And the reason that is because sometimes you actually don't want HTML for whatever reason. Like you want the actual raw version. And then it just gets weird because you never really know sort of what you have. You know, you end up having to unconvert it and then convert it to something else. And you end up with double conversion issues. And it gets really weird. You'd be surprised. You'd think, okay, what could it really hurt to have HTML stored in the database? And then it just gets really awkward.
I wouldn't think that. But okay.
Well, that's what I thought initially.
Yeah.
But yeah, it gets really awkward. So you were totally right about that. I think you want to have the raw version. And I think what I was thinking was that this is actually more efficient.
Right.
When it comes to the post title, there are cases because we display post title a bunch of places. And usually there's a shared function that's displaying the title. But not always. So it's actually a little tiny bit safer in that we 99.9% of the time, 99.999% of the time, we have an encoded version that we're working with. So in undoing that was actually particularly painful because we had to be really, really careful.
So wait, did you actually change the database format now so that it's no longer?
Yeah, we did. I actually had to go in and there's a stored procedure that someone wrote that actually gives you the ability in SQL Server to unconvert HTML as a proc. So I actually called that, unconverted everything, once I had fixed the code. And then we convert everything on the fly for these small fields, mm-hmm. which makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, because who knows? One of these days, somebody's going to make a version of Stack Overflow that's not for HTML.
Well, yeah, that's certainly what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And the only there is one exception to that, which is that if you want to store both versions, that can be okay depending on what you're doing.
Well, that's a matter of caching for speed, and then it's just a question of whether you can get the addition if it's even worth it.
Yeah, right. And then we do that, for example, a post body. And that was definitely clearly the right decision there. It's like for the current version of a post, because we have revisions on posts where you can go in and edit over time, the latest revision is always raw HTML. In other words, it's been pre-converted from Markdown. Mm-hmm. But we have both representations. In other words, I can get the HTML or I can go into the revision history for the current version and get the raw version. So that's okay. I mean, you can store both versions as long as you have good naming conventions so you don't get confused about which is which. But yeah, you were totally right. And I was actually sort of cursing your name. I was like, God, Joel was right about this. I was like, this is a really bad idea. I don't know what I was thinking.
All right. Victory lap. Next.
Exactly.
Let's put it this way. What's the computer software engineering principle here?
Well, it's just precision. I mean, I think you were right about that. It's like you want to store at the highest possible level of precision.
I'm sort of thinking that, I mean, are there other examples of this? I think that HTML is really, you want to store it with the greatest possible fidelity, basically.
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to. And it's also a little bit simpler because you always know that you have the mm-hmm. raw version. You don't have to think about, okay, what version do I have?
Given the difficulty of converting HTML to anything else in a safe way or a reliable way, It's probably better to think of your data types. If your data type is a string, that should just be a string. It shouldn't be encoded in any unusual way. And so if you're using a programming language where the default string type is in Unicode, which most modern programming languages, well, many modern programming languages, that's true, then you shouldn't be thinking about UTF-8 unless you have to write it out to a file or write it out in UTF-8. And then worry about encoding it, because otherwise, you're just gonna be making mistakes. And if you have a general rule that we always keep everything in as native a format as possible until the last minute when it needs to be converted for a specific application, then you're probably gonna be safer.
Right, and then there's a lot of surprisingly subtle things even within HTML. Like, let me give you an example. So, like, say you want to output the title, in HTML, okay, that's fine. You call it HTML encode. But if you're outputting the title of a post as the title, the actual title element in HTML.
In the head.
Yeah, in the head. That has actually different encoding rules.
Well, you can't use any tags in there at all.
Well, that's right. You have to, exactly. You have to treat it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
So that was one of the situations I ran into specifically with title, was that it got a little weird. And then when you're encoding values in forms in HTML, That's a kind of subtly different set of encoding rules, too.
One of the things that I found that ASP.NET and ASP.NET MVC are remarkably inconsistent about is whether various properties, which are going to become eventually a part of an HTML page, should be provided in HTML or not. So if you have, if you're setting the, I don't know, like the text property of a label in classic ASP.NET, I'm pretty sure that one, you can't put HTML in there. It'll convert it to HTML for you, or it'll escape it for you. But there are situations where that's not the case. And it's just hard to know which it's going to be. And that's just, every single example of inconsistency in ASP.NET between whether the properties should be set with some HTML or set with, just a plain string and it'll be encoded for you, is just a encoding error waiting to happen.
Well, that's, I think, more of a web forms thing. Now, mm-hmm. the problem we run into with MVC, because it's more of a to-the-metal kind of framework, is that you have to be, and this is, I guess, sort of obvious at some level, but you have to be really careful when you're outputting data on the screen that the user has actually put into the system that you're encoding it, right? I mean, this is like cross-site scripting 101.
But you see, it is actually possible. It would be possible to develop a framework for programming the web in which it is almost impossible to make that mistake.
Well, okay, this is what I'm getting at. I want to cover this because this is actually one of my major beefs with MVC, such as it is.
Yeah.
And it's not really ASP.NET MVC's fault. It's actually the underlying view engine, the ASP.NET view engine, of when you're using what they call the B stings, which is, you know, less than percent, right? Where you sort of you're escaping out of the world of static markup and into some dynamic variable that's going to be output on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the default for that is to just output it verbatim as is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is like horribly, horribly wrong.
Because
like,
you always have to type server.html encode.
Yeah, you always have to type server. Well, actually, MVC, it's html.encode, which is a little bit nicer of a synonym.
HTML.encode.
Same thing. Yeah.
Well, if you're going to type it every time, make it E. That's what I always do. I always define a function called E.
E. Nice. What about A, B, and C?
No, E encode. Or E encode.
Oh, well, of course. E is encode.
It's the most common thing to do. I want it to be one letter.
Right. So this is where I want to get a little political. It's like I have a, based on the number of times, so the problem with this approach is all you have to do is forget to encode one time.
One thing. Yep.
One time.
Mm-hmm.
In one place in your entire application.
Yep.
That is ultimately data entered by a user and you're totally owned. Like, I mean, totally owned.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's almost like the bad old days of C where like if you have a pointer allocation that goes a little bit that you don't check in one place in your code. Like
that's
they
what
can
they're
going to
find.
Machine.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're back in the bad old days of C.
Exactly. And there
really
is a solution
to this.
Somebody, actually, I'm not a super duper excellent C# lawyer, but in C++, there would be a solution for this, or in any language that's type safe and has automatic type conversions. Because what you would do is you simply declare that there are two kinds of strings, HTML strings and string strings. And unless something is an HTML string, it will get encoded. Whenever you pass it to any function expecting an HTML string. So you have a string, you pass it to some function that's going to output it. It needs an HTML string. It has to call the converter to convert from a string to an HTML string, and it encodes it for you.
Yes.
And you can just use these things freely without ever worrying about it. And if you ever happen to want to somehow inject some less thans into the actual HTML stream because you have to, then you set a property like inner HTML that's expecting a string, not an HTML string. Or or you cast it, but at least the explicit operate, you have to do an explicit operation when you want to unsafely put something in the HTML, and everything else is safe.
I totally agree with that, and that's kind of what I'm getting to here. Is that I think I know this would break a lot of the underlying assumptions and break a lot of the core programming, but I think it's hugely important. Particularly when it comes to MVC, because you're typically down to the metal, like you're doing a B sting and then equals, which means, okay, I'm going to take this value and I'm just going to dump it into the page.
Yep.
A lot of people, me including, have maintained that that should be encoded by default. And if you want to unencode, like if you want raw values to be output to the page, it should be a different convention.
Yep.
Like instead of equals, it should be like exclamation point.
Yeah.
You know, to indicate, okay, this is dangerous. I'm going to output dangerous raw data to the page at this point.
Right.
And then at least like it's safe by default. Like there's this philosophy of that Microsoft finally adopted in their operating systems of, you know, doing everything in the safest possible way by default, like turning off all the services you're not going to need, you know, and generally just not enabling things by default. And this really falls under that philosophy is like,
it should,
you know, it's much harder to screw up when everything's encoded.
And forget
default.
the what did you call it? Bee sting? What?
Yeah, I think they're called bee stings. Like I've heard them
like
referred to.
Well,
that's a classic escape character.
Less than percent, yeah.
Ruby
but,
as well.
But forget that. Also, just assigning properties of things. You're assigning the text property or something in code, on the code side.
Right.
And sometimes, I don't even know what the rules are. Sometimes you have to turn on or off this HTML encode bit. Sometimes you just put it in there. All right, we've beat that one to death.
Well, that's an important one, though. I mean, I have really strong feelings about that, just based on the number of times like we have truly screwed up.
It's
like,
never
we just
look. It's never going to get fixed. Have to be a new framework before this ever gets fixed.
Yeah, it's really bad. Every time that happens, I curse, and it's just human nature. I mean, we just make mistakes.
And I actually don't. I mean, I don't know of a lot of the more esoteric frameworks, but I don't know of a framework that that is strict in that way and then well, enforces things getting HTML encoded.
My understanding is, okay, so there's a couple things. Django, yeah. I believe, which is the Python framework, I believe has that encode by default type output. At least I was told that on Twitter. So if it's wrong, then I can blame Twitter.
Well,
for that.
You can't. I won't. I mean, I'm happy to consider that as, okay, it's got the right default. But I want to go further and actually say it is using the type checker of the compiler to ensure that your code does not have cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, which can be done just using types if you have a statically typed language. And means no Python or Ruby. I'm sorry. You're just automatically disqualified because your language isn't tightly, you know, type safe.
Well, I don't know. That seems like it would be really performance intensive. I don't know.
No. What I'm describing all happens at compile time, right? Because it looks at the string and it says, oh, this is a string. I cannot possibly put it out into the HTML page because it's a string and the HTML page needs an encoded string. So that's a type error, right? Expected encoded string, found a string. And it all happens at compile time. It's not inefficient at all.
Oh, so there's some special data type for these.
Yeah, there's a different data type for strings that can be output to the page. It's a class that derives from string, but you can't use a string in place because it's expecting an encoded string. Yeah. And it might have a built-in conversion that does it for you automatically.
Yeah. Well, something that dramatic might actually be called for. I mean, given that cross-site scripting is, I think, easily the number one vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And it's a really serious vulnerability. I don't know if people understand.
It's the buffer overflow of the 21st century.
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like an epidemic, actually. And it really is. And it's this current state of affairs, the current status quo is just really bad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think something that fundamental, it sounds a little bit like boiling the ocean, but it actually might not be, given the depth of the problem.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway.
All right, cool. What else have we got on the agenda?
Well, we started a logo contest for superuser.com.
Oh, yeah. And you did that on some different website this time. Is that just for
yeah.
the
yeah.
diversity?
Well, somebody from CrowdSpring. I had heard of CrowdSpring. It's prior to this, we had used a site called 99designs.com, which I was perfectly happy with. But I thought I would sort of spread the love a little bit and try CrowdSpring out.
CrowdSpring,
what kind of results we get there. But it's a similar sort of experience in that you set up sort of a contest. And the one thing that's nice about CrowdSpring is they do have multiple awards set up. Because based on the previous contest, I felt that was important that multiple people sort of win because they're investing their time. And a lot of times these logo contests, you know, it's very subjective who wins anyway. and you want to kind of reward the top N people. Mm-hmm. So we're explicitly able to do that on CrowdSpring, which I do like. We have three awards set up, 768, 200, and 200.
How do I find this contest on CrowdSpring?
I linked to it on the blog. I'll have to put it in the show notes.
Okay.
But it's hopefully a web search would pick it up if you just do super user design logo contest. That's my hope anyway.
Oh, I see here. It's got some long URL. It doesn't have a clever URL. Creative Brief. Hey, my name is in there.
Yep.
What is this? I'm the handsome one? Delete.
Delete.
Is there a way
I'm just trying to keep it fun and punchy, Joel. People had to read all that text, you know. But I was just trying to explain. I'm actually kind of excited about the super user site, because I feel like this is going to be the site that the average computer user is going to be most likely to be able to use. Because prior to this, you know, our previous sites were very narrow and focused, right? Like for programmers, we had Stack Overflow. And if you're a sysadmin or, you know, an IT pro, then you have Serverfall. But this is just sort of the average, everyday computer enthusiast website. There's just a lot more of those than there are programmers and, you know, sysadmins. Plus, there's a lot of crossover. People got frustrated. They couldn't post just like random computer questions and a programmer as a system admin. So I think it's going to be a fun site, because it's going to almost be, people always say, well, why isn't there like an anything goes site? And this is going to be as close as we ever get to that.
It's still going to be,
which we may
kind of
regret at
thing.
Some level, but we'll super user is going to be fun. And I think for the logo and the design contest, it's almost a little bit like that anything goes philosophy. Like, I don't feel like we have to have a logo that matches our current design aesthetic. It could be some other crazy logo that we've never would have normally considered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit like an anything goes Wild West type of experience. And I'm kind of hoping the logo can kind of capture that feeling a little bit.
Guns? Horses and guns and...
Well, if it's like the internet, it should be like people yelling
campfires.
At each other. That's
two people screaming at each other, turning red.
And that's inevitably what it gets to. Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. But I'm excited about Super User.
Me too. Yeah, and then we'll have the trilogy. That's all we're doing. Then we're done. Then we're stopping.
Well, we're not done. I wouldn't say we're done, but certainly I really did have a vision of like sort of the topics I wanted to cover with the engine, like that I personally wanted to see and I personally wanted to use.
We had a couple others. We had the idea of a system builder one and a gamer one. Those were the other two that I could think of.
But I think those could kind of fall under Super User. I mean, so, they would be sort of subcultures that could exist there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, that might be.
I mean, you could always get more narrow. I mean, we've talked about this before where the more narrow you are, ultimately, the better in the big scheme of things. But it's sort of my hope that those subcultures can live at Super User and sort of
Or you could
in.
Sign up for Stack Exchange and just pay us $129 a month and make your own gamer website.
Yeah, exactly. You could get ultra narrow, yeah, using the hosted version, certainly. No. I'm also excited about the hosted version because I do feel like, you know, you brought up the cooking one. And somebody actually, we made reference to that cooking site.
Yeah, we don't know where it is, but...
And then somebody found another one that I hadn't
cooking sites?
They were like, oh, I found it. I found that thing you were talking about. It's like, no, that's not at all what I was talking about. That's something else. But it ends up being, it's related to us. Like in their about page, like they cite us and say that, you know, we're heavily influenced by, you know, Stack Overflow, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So there's yet another one of these sites popping up. So the sites are truly popping up all over the place that are sort of influenced by the design that we put out there, which is, you know, hugely flattering. But on the other hand, it indicates a clear need for these narrow topics that we're not going to be able to get to, like cooking or whatever. So there's clearly a need for this. And the sooner we can fill that need, I think the happier, the more options everybody has. They don't really have to use our stuff necessarily, but I like to think that our engine is the original flavor.
It's the, you know, like reference implementation.
Yeah, it's like the kernel's magic formula with the 13 spices and delicious juices. And hopefully getting that out there will be, you know, satisfying to people in some way that they can actually use the original engine to do whatever they want for any topic that they think it's appropriate for. Because, gosh, the number of emails we've gotten is just truly astonishing on that.
Yeah, well, we'll have a placement to sign up as soon as my computer recovers. I was going to sit down and write a dumb little application because we're going to have the Stack Exchange thing or whatever we end up calling it. I'm just trying to make a sign-up form on the web. That's all. That, you know, just so we can start, you know, getting these people that are really anxious to make one. The service probably won't be available until, I think I'm saying September 1st now. That should be possible.
Okay. Well, good. I would love for there to be like a public news page.
Yeah, I tried to make a sign up page and for people that want to at least sign up to get notified when it's ready and reserve a space in the first batch because we'll probably be limited in the capacity. And so I designed all the HTML and I was about to add the little form where you sign up and I thought I'd do that in ASP.NET MVC and then I had something was wrong with Visual Studio and that's how I got into this 3 days of reinstalling my entire computer.
You should have gotten a Mac, Joel.
Which we opened with.
That. I just want to preemptively say that because I know somebody's going to be in the comments. You should have gotten a Mac.
Yeah, and that would have. Yep. I should have. Do you want to take a listener question?
Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
Hi, Jeff and Joel. My name is Joseph Steins. I wonder, now that you have the jobs part of the site up and running, how do you think that will affect the character of the question and answer part of the site? In particular, now that users know that future employers may be watching and may come back and review their posts, how do you think that will affect the questions and answers and comments that are left on the site? And do you think that it will prevent people from asking newbie questions or giving partial answers? Thanks very much. Bye.
Do you have an opinion on that, Joel?
I do. My opinion on that is that I think it could only be good, right?
Like, I think
to the extent that somebody says, some future employer might see this, it's going to cause people to be on their best behavior, I hope. Which they already are. You know, we have pretty good behavior on Stack Overflow relative to what you might expect from a bunch of...
Yeah, well, right, because other users are watching and they're able to sort of rate your...
Yeah, you're going to get voted on and stuff. Yeah. But even, yeah. I mean, even the comments on Reddit are sometimes unbelievably immature or just rude or obnoxious. And you're going to lose a bunch of points, but people still do it. Or maybe they make a throwaway account for that. So, and I think actually probably a lot of people are going to wind up with two Stack Overflow accounts, one in which they're abusive or they post their stuff that they're not so proud of, and one which represents the, you know, what they want the world to see.
You know, actually, I have seen that. But, you know, the problem with accounts like that is we tend to delete accounts like that. I'm just going to warn you. I really do, because if I see somebody that has just a history of posting just really annoying, aggravating
things. Oh, you
things,
mean if they, yeah. Well, I think that
really
they might be
high on my list of deletions, believe me, and I will do that. So.
Sure.
I don't want you to, I'm a little concerned because you're kind of encouraging people to create, like, fun accounts to do stupid things. Yeah. No, just behave responsibly. And I think my whole rant on this comes down to the way people behave when they think nobody's watching versus the way people behave when they know people are watching, mm-hmm. right? And I would argue that any society or any system where you get behaviors as if everybody's anonymous and nobody's watching mm-hmm. are really broken systems. Like, it just never – nothing good comes of that.
Sure.
And I think you have certain types of people that even if nobody's watching, they'll still kind of behave and do the right things. But I think that's a small minority of the overall population of people in the world. And I think this goes back to, like, and one thing I never really understood is, like, high school students and college students that sort of use Facebook and stuff and sort of post things that they wouldn't want the world to see mm-hmm. and sort of get themselves in trouble because it becomes visible through various mechanisms. I never really understood those behaviors because to me, the sooner you learn that you're sort of a citizen of the world in some greater sense, and it's okay to do some stupid things, but, like, you should never post anything that you wouldn't want. And I believe, did we say this in the podcast? Like, as if your mother is there watching, right? Like, everything you do.
Yeah, I never heard that.
That becomes public in some way in the world. Like, you should be okay with your mom seeing this.
Right.
Right. And it just astonished me. Like, that's such a simple rule, right?
Don't,
like,
there's a rule on Wall Street. Don't send any email that you don't want published in the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, exactly.
Ever.
Exactly.
Just pick up
exactly.
the phone. It's so easy. If you want to say something that you're going to regret,
yeah.
just do it by phone.
And I think there's ways, like, if you disagree with someone or if you're, you know, you're angry or you're just trying to have fun, there's ways to do all this stuff and not make yourself
well, I
look
think
like an idiot
there's
in
also,
the process.
There's also a non-abusive behavior, which is somebody might have some just slightly embarrassing newbie questions that they consider to be newbie questions or embarrassingly easy questions. And they might think, you know, this is somewhere, there's going to be some employer, potential employer looking at this, and they're just going to take it the wrong way. And it doesn't make sense for me. I'm perfectly just because I see that somebody's a newbie at some technology, you know, they're asking a question. You know, that wouldn't lower them in my eyes. I mean, that wouldn't make me think that they're a worse programmer. It just means that they don't know this new technology.
Right? Or they have a fundamental set of curiosities about
yeah.
the world.
Maybe they're trying. Maybe it's not what they're claiming to be an expert on. On the other hand, if somebody tells you they have 8 years of C++ experience and you see them asking questions that don't even make sense within the framework of a C++ programmer.
That is true. I will say you should avoid asking questions that other people look at and go, what are you asking?
WT, yeah.
Like, yeah, this doesn't even compute. Like, your question is nonsensical. That's bad.
Right.
I will say that. But, I mean...
But go ahead and ask. And we do want people to ask the novice questions because we want to have the canonical answers. Like, I am just trying to get drag and drop to work on an iPhone. How do I do that? I need a tutorial on drag and drop on the iPhone. And
well,
I'd love to have that stuff, even if that stuff may be in TFM. I'd love to have that stuff on Stack Overflow too.
Yeah. Well, you know, you always say that. And I think I've seen some semi-abusive questions on Stack Overflow that ask things that are just so simple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like I'm learning the Logo programming language and I want to move my turtle simple.
Okay. Yeah, but okay.
You understand what I'm saying? Like,
no.
I've seen people.
Yeah, but that's because there are people who are going to go to the internet
this.
And type. How do I move my turtle in Logo?
But, okay.
And they want that. I'm looking that up right now.
Okay.
That should
All
be
right.
on there, actually.
Well, look, I mean, you're not on Stack Overflow as much as I'm on Stack Overflow. I think people have heard you say this.
Move turtle.
And they've actually taken it to absurd lengths to prove a point. And it can be done the wrong way. So I will say that.
We don't even have an answer to how to move a turtle and Logo on our website.
You know, this is you know what's going to happen now, sadly. Like, we've discussed this. Some
I'm asking it right now.
Is going to decide that there has to be this question on Stack Overflow on how to move your logo turtle. So now I kind of regret having this conversation even. But my point is that it is possible to ask simple questions that I think are of low value. And it's possible to ask simple questions that are of high value. And it's all about, you know, how you ask and sort of the amount of research you've done before you ask. Like, you know.
1003841. You are wrong. It's not about the amount of research. I disagree with that. If the only research you have to do before you ask a question on Stack Overflow is make sure it's not already in Stack Overflow, because I don't want a bunch of dupes, because that's a problem. Yeah. But it just because the answer is on Google and some other website, I don't care, because I want that traffic. I want the traffic coming to Stack Overflow where it's editable and it's a wiki and people vote on it. Just because there's an answer over on some sex change website, don't care. I want the answer to be on. And if the answer is in the documentation, but you don't understand it or it's incomprehensible, it is better for the answer to be on Stack Overflow because you can edit it, you can vote it up. So we want all knowledge.
I think you hit on one of the key points there, though, which is that you don't feel there's a good answer anywhere else. Like, I've certainly run into that myself.
Just said explicitly, even if there is a good answer somewhere else.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that. I think if there's a good answer somewhere else, you essentially quote it or link it.
Yeah. Don't even link it or quote it. Just you could ask the question on Stack Overflow, and then you find the answer somewhere else, answer it here too, you know, and you can edit that. But we're sort of like building an encyclopedia of knowledge questions. I keep saying this. And an encyclopedia has to have an entry for cat, even though everybody knows what a cat is, and you can always find that in the dictionary.
Well,
not a reason not to have cat in your encyclopedia.
Well, I think that's too much of a purist approach. I mean, you have to realize we're a hybrid system.
We are a hybrid system, but I don't want to be
hybrid. So, like, if you take it too far down that avenue, it gets really weird.
Why? I don't really care.
Because it's not really fun for the other people to answer those questions. That's what it boils down to.
It's
because
fun
if the question is, it has no subtlety to it at all. It's like, what is 1 + 1, right?
That's not a question, though.
Oh, no, that's a question. But you see what I'm saying? It's not really fun to answer because there's no subtlety to it. It's just, okay,
it's two. Especially fun to answer because it's so easy.
Well, it's too easy, though. I mean, there's such a thing
as up.
Too easy to answer. Yeah. It's all about the audience. Like, is it really fun for the other programmers to consider?
I don't care. Don't care. Because we're all building an encyclopedia. Let me be real explicit here. The attitude you're giving me is going dangerously close to the people on comp.lang.c who refused to answer a question because that same question was asked 4.5 years ago. And why didn't you notice that it was asked then?
No. That's not at all. I think you're mischaracterizing.
And they only want new things. They only want complicated new things coming across. I'm not saying that you're saying that. I'm saying that you're going in that direction dangerously. Here, my question is 1003841.
1003841.
Whoa, Richie Hindle gets a point.
but you asked the question, which is good. But since you're Joel Spolsky, you have influenced the question, unfortunately. You should have asked it as an anonymous user, and I think you would not have gotten such a happy reception.
I would have gotten bashed bloody with a 2x4.
Yeah.
Beaten up by a gang. Let's take a different... all right, there are two possible approaches there. One is that all possible questions... You could possibly come up with a question that's too easy, but... It's not going to be something like, you know, anything that somebody learning a programming language might conceivably want to ask the Google in the words that they would conceivably use is a legit question. If they're learning how to program and they just don't get what the open squiggly brace does, they're trying to figure this out. They see these braces all over the place. They don't know what they do. They want to go ask, what does this little squiggly brace thing do in C? They're going to type that into the Google. I want to have the answer to that. I want to own that. And those questions are going to have a lot of traffic because the newbie questions are going to be the most common questions. And I want to have every possible shape, every different name for that squiggly brace thing. I want to have all the different variations on that question as well because, you know, you never know what somebody types into Google and wants to find the answer to.
Well, my position is trying to be a little bit nicer to the people answering the question because those are the people actually doing the work essentially for you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of like blogging. You want to write a blog post that's actually going to be interesting to the people that are reading it. In other words, as you write, you have to sort of be cognizant of the audience and like sort of satisfying the audience's need for exploration or understanding. And if it's such a simple question that, like, there's just one answer, you know, a canonical answer, it's impossible to have any subtlety or you know, partially right or partially wrong answers. Or, like, you know, programmers love, like, and this is typical in programming, there's 100 different ways to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And none of them are exactly right. So you can sort of discuss, like, well, sometimes you do this and sometimes you do this. And this is the essence of being a professional programmer. It's like you have a chessboard and there's an infinity of moves.
Okay, but I think there are lots of programmers that are not nearly that sophisticated who can answer simple questions and would be happy to do so. And that would be fun for them. And well, they may be a little bit frustrated by how they can never, you know, they can never find enough questions to answer that they're capable of answering on Stack Overflow.
But to me, it's about fun. It's like, what questions are really fun to answer? And to a certain extent, simple questions are fun, like you said, because there's it's easy to knock them out. But if it's possible for it to be too simple. I think
I'm trying to think of what was it. What can you think of when you were learning how to program some technology? Not necessarily learning how to program, but just some specific language you were trying to learn or something. What really stupid question did you have that you just couldn't figure out?
Oh, well, the hardest questions, I think, to figure out when you're starting a new programming language are the ones where, like, it's the terms are so broad, so general. Like, what you're asking is hard to even put into words.
Right.
Because it's so straightforward. It's like everybody else sort of figures it out immediately. Have you ever been stuck in, like, a video game? Like, you're at a point in a video game where, like, I don't know how to do X.
It's just impossible. I have to jump in some ridiculous way. I can't do it.
And, like, you have to figure out, like, okay, how do you even figure out how other people would be asking this? That becomes the real challenge.
Right.
It's not,
right.
Okay, I'm stuck at X. It's like, how do I figure out how to even ask this in a way that makes sense?
I can't remember. There's one game I played. I mean, it was like a 3D shooter, and the total amount of time that I spent on that game was probably something like 50 hours, of which 30 were spent trying to get past this one particular point.
Like, I've been stuck in video games in ways that I don't think many people have, because it'll be something that I didn't see, some door. Like, I just happened to miss. Like, it was just on the edge of the screen. I didn't quite see it.
I'll give you an example. I didn't even see this. I had a when I was learning how to program in C, I put a semicolon after the function declaration before the first squiggly brace. Because I just was like, it's at the end of the line or something. Yeah, I worked on that for hours before I finally had to show it to somebody, and they're like, oh, here's your problem.
Yeah. Well, that's a good example of show, don't tell, right, which you've always been talking about. So on Stack Overflow, you would show. You'd say, well, here's the code.
What do
so
I do?
So rather than talking about an abstract concept,
what the hell did it do?
Like, just show us the code. Like, shut up. We don't care. Just show us the code, and we'll tell you what you're doing wrong.
But sometimes you have – I mean, I think that there are real newbie questions that people do get stuck on for hours early on.
I'm sure there are.
And I'd love to see those questions asked on Stack Overflow and answered.
Okay. Well, okay. I believe the same thing, but I would add a caveat, a little asterisk there that would say, you know, ask in a way that's interesting.
Jeff, this question is on fire. I've already got 5 points. Somebody's linked to it. I got the complete. Here's a complete background. It's got the colors. Somebody's pasted in a whole turtle graphics. This is nice. I like it. Check it out. 100-3841. Let's take another listener question.
Hi, Joel and Jeff. My name is Frank Kruger. I'm from Seattle, Washington. I have a question about finding beta testers for an application. Overall, I've thought out the user scenarios, but at the same time, I know that the application was created in a vacuum based upon my own personal desires and problems. So I have a question whether to do a open call beta test or a closed call, as in, should I find a list of 50 people that I would love to have in the beta, send them emails, beg them to be in it, or should I just start a blog and have an open call for testers? Keep up the great work. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, I think, Frank, that you're if you don't already have a blog, then you probably don't really have any choice. You're going to get the people that you can get. You don't have a really gigantic audience available to you immediately. I mean, you'd have to build that audience. So no matter what you're going to do, I think you're probably going to have to work pretty hard to get beta testers. And one thing to remember is that maybe 1 in 10 beta testers that you sign up are actually going to be beta testers, probably even less nowadays. In other words, you're only going to get 1 in 10 people actually trying the thing out. And and so forth. So in order to get reasonable feedback on a first version of something, you're probably going to want to have at least 50 to 100 beta testers. And there's an article on my website called Top 12 Tips for Running a Beta Test, joelandsoftware.com/articles/betatest.html. In that one, I said explicitly, you don't want to have an open beta test. You can't have an unlimited number of beta testers. That's not going to work. Also, when you do have the beta testers, you don't want to burn them all too quickly. A beta tester is going to give you one or two pieces of feedback, and then they're going to feel like they did their job, and they're not going to send you any further feedback. So if you have 100 really enthusiastic people that are really going to work with this thing and try it and send you some feedback, then you probably want to split them up over five different releases, give each release to 20 different people or 20 additional people. Because otherwise, you know, all 100 will give you the same piece of feedback of something in your first beta test. When time comes to the second beta test, you won't hear anything from anybody.
Yeah, beta testing is sort of an art, and I'm personally really bad at it. So, I mean, it's easy to beta at test your own tester. Application.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because as the developer, you're all invested in it. You know, it's you're kind of cheating. It's like your baby. So, of course, you're going to be invested in it.
You also, but it's really important. You have the curse of knowledge. I keep saying the curse of knowledge. It's like my new thing to say.
No, that's true. It's true.
But you know how your application works. So you're too focused on, you don't know what other people think about it because you know how it works. And so it works great for you. And you can hardly believe it when they install it and they can't even make it work or they can't do the Macy. There was an application that launched this week. Did you see this application from, what's her name? Katarina.
Oh yeah.
Fake.
I did. Hunch. Yeah. I did.
Katarina Fake, who created Flickr, made a website called hunch.com, and I went there. Whoa, what is that? What was that sound? Did I do that?
Podcast bingo. Everybody fill that in. Yeah, that's a good one.
You go to hunch.com, and it says, where's your home located? In the suburbs, in a rural area, in a city? I don't get it. I don't get this website. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, isn't it sort of like 20 questions? Isn't it sort of harnessing?
And then what happens? You
know, 20 questions applied to questions you might actually have in the real world.
But people have done that before, and it never works.
Well, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I'll give them credit. I'm intrigued by the idea. I'm not necessarily a huge fan.
I give it 10 minutes.
I'm not sure I would actually be a user of the site, but it's a neat idea. I'm interested to see if it works or not.
I couldn't even figure it out. I went to the site and I played with it for a long time, and I couldn't even figure out what it was trying to do. And so that's the kind of thing that a beta test would show
you.
Well,
yeah, that's the kind of thing that a beta test would tell you is like, can other users even figure out what the hell it is you're doing?
Right.
You know, like, what does this mean? Why would I use this?
Find the core pieces of functionality that you want them to be using.
Yeah. No, totally. I think one thing you got to kind of watch out for, my initial piece of advice based on that question was, there's websites you can go to where a bunch of people just sit around and like they love beta testing so much that they'll beta test anything.
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing. That sounds like a good thing. Yeah.
Right. So you would go there and say, okay, I'm starting this project. It does this. And you'd have a built-in audience, right?
But I think our second best beta tester of CityDesk of all times was this high school kid who, when I Googled him, came up with an article from the Boston Globe about how he loves to beta test. This is his hobby. And he got himself in a local newspaper because he beta tests so much. And he did. He came up with a long, good list of useful feedback.
Yeah. No, some of that can be good. And then the one thing I do worry about, though, is and it pains me to even say this because you're kind of turning on your users at this point. Mm-hmm. But you have certain users that are too invested in the app. Like, I don't know. There's a fine line. Like, sometimes with Stack Overflow, I kind of want to say to people, it's like, okay, you need to stop. You need to step back. Mm-hmm. And realize that Stack Overflow is not a religion. You know, it's not a lifestyle, right? It's a site that's trying to solve a problem for programmers, right? Like, and it doesn't necessarily require that everybody using it be, you know, totally personally invested in it. Now, on the other hand, like, obviously, I encourage people to enjoy and use the software, and I don't want to be the guy telling people, you know, don't enjoy it too much, right? Like, if you're having fun, then continue to have fun using Stack Overflow, but sometimes with particularly when you go with open call to beta testers, you get people that are more interested in the concept than your application. right? It's this weird dynamic, and I think you got to be a little bit careful with some of the beta testers, like you, because I know some of the feedback we get on our user voice site, like I can't really do anything with it because it's such a narrow, like, desire. And I think John Skeet has actually even talked about this in some of his user voice postings, was like, we have to focus on the things that feed the 90% of users that really don't care about our site. They're just there to get the answer and move on, right? Versus the 10% of people who are there all the time. And you know, obviously they're an important part of the audience, but they're 10% of the audience, mm-hmm. right? And I think with beta testers, you can get into that where you're getting these narrow users that are more interested in their personal experience than sort of the average user would be.
Right. They might be the early adopters.
Yeah, you get the early adopters who are, you know, very gung-ho, but in ways that might be weird for that take your product and software in strange directions that wouldn't necessarily feed the average user. So I think you have to kind of put on your glasses of like, does this feedback fit what we believe to be the average user's reaction is going to be, unless you can actually get average users. Now on Stack Overflow, we have a huge number of users now. So we can sort of look at the data and say, okay, this is what people say, and this is what people actually do, right? Mm-hmm. As a mass, as a whole. And then we have to sort of heavily weight the numbers based on what's actually happening on the site versus the feedback that we're getting. And certainly when you start out in an early beta, you're going to have this disconnect because you don't have a mass of users. You just have these really gung-ho hardcore users that, you know, you what they say is what you kind of have to believe because you don't have enough data to go on.
Right. Yeah, 1.0s are hard. 2.0s, that's it. It becomes very path-dependent. And if you're lucky, then you've started to go down a path with your design and your audience that can snowball into something large and successful. But it's also possible that you've accidentally picked up I'm trying to think of a general way to put this, but sometimes you just accidentally pick up a particular niche that has their very, very specific needs for their niche, and you cater to them because they're your users, they're the people who are paying you, and you somehow build this product that's awesome for this tiny niche, and you just accidentally miss this gigantic market that's right next to your niche, but which you aren't catering to. Can't think of a good example of that, but anyway.
Sure, Joel. Sure, whatever.
Now, what would be an example? You know, example of that would be, you know, we never Fogbugs is a product that we created for managing software projects that's used by software developers, and you can imagine another product that does exactly the same thing that's used by building managers to keep track of all of the repairs that need to be done in the building, right? And it's the same kind of thing. You keep track of repairs. You assign them to people to do. You know, maybe the person who's in charge of, you know, keeping the infrastructure of a large campus operating would want a database that's much like a bug tracking database. You know, there's a pipe that burst in such and such a place, or somebody needs to paint this thing because the paint is chipping. And a bug tracking database would be perfect for that, but our product isn't really made for that market, right?
I see. So it's like a building bug tracker.
Yeah, building bug tracker.
You have bugs in your building.
Exactly. And that building
manager.
Maybe
literally, you have bugs in your building.
Right. It could be bugs. It could be cockroaches. And that guy is not going to know to look for a bug tracker, even though it would work for them. They're going to look for a building management information system tracker, McCallit thingamajiggy, if they even have such a thing. And, you know, it's conceivable that we could have, you know, had a few people like that in our beta test and started to cater to them and make a great product for them and advertise
yes,
to them.
Yes. And it's basically a small sample size problem, right? Isn't that essentially what it is?
Exactly. Yeah. And who's to tell you today whether there's a bigger market for building bug trackers versus software bug trackers? I don't even know. But, you know, we went down that one particular path. We might have gone down that other path, and then we'd be just totally stuck there, just like we're stuck where we are right now, you know?
Yeah.
You can always do
have
the
you
other
guys
thing.
Actually started to go in that direction with
building bug trackers?
Bugs?
No. No.
I mean, are you trying to market it to sort of non-
Nope.
Software. Okay. So you haven't, this is completely theoretical then.
This is, well, no, I'm just saying maybe we went down the wrong path. Maybe it's more useful to use this as a, you know, making a movie software and you could charge more money
for it. But you guys have the hosted Fogbugs. Does anyone take hosted Fogbugs and do stuff like this with it?
They might. I don't know. I don't really know. Nobody's really come to us and said, this is what we, yeah. I mean, we don't hear from those people and we don't really cater to them when they do ask for certain things.
There's, maybe that's because maybe that's impossible. Maybe if you're generalizing like that, you can't ever satisfy a niche. It's not possible.
Well, I'll give you a better example. There are a lot of people that try to use Fogbooks to do what Salesforce does because Salesforce is so expensive and presumably crappy as well. And it doesn't do all the things that Salesforce does by any stretch of the imagination. And so they keep asking for features that are like right out of Salesforce. And we tend to turn them down because we're trying to make, that's never the most important feature for a software developer. But, maybe selling to salespeople would be a much, much larger market than selling to software developers. Or maybe not.
Well, this
not.
Was always, well, I think this is why you guys will be good at developing the hosted Stack Overflow, because one of my deep, deep concerns with doing that, one of the reasons I didn't want to do it personally was because I felt like you would be pulled in all these crazy directions because you would have all these verticals.
Right.
People trying to do these vertical things like, oh, I have a cooking Stack Overflow or, oh, I have the building Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
And like they would want all these things that were very incompatible, that fed their vertical need but didn't feed the core engine. And it's like, how do you balance that? And it sounds like you guys haven't even tried to do that on the hosted Fogbug side at all. And I can understand why, because it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you serve everybody, you serve nobody, right? I mean, this is the classic problem. It's like if you're trying to solve everybody's problem, you're going to come up with something so general that it's just going to suck.
And they're not going to know. They're not going to know to look for it. They're like, I need a bug tracker, and you're like, oh, I know what you're looking for. You're looking for an open issue database. They're like, no, I want a bug tracker. It's like, look for open issue databases and you'll find it. The people have to know that a category exists before they will type it into Google and buy the product.
Yeah.
And if you try to make something that's too general, that solves everybody's issues and tracks them, you're not really serving anybody.
Well, that's like the classic, content management system, which is one of my favorite buzzwords that doesn't actually mean anything. It's like, what do these things do? It's like you end up with, let me just tell you guys what happens. At the end of this road is Lotus Notes. I'm just warning you. Right? And like you don't want to go there. Yeah. Right? That's like the dark place.
People made billions.
Oh yeah, you could make billions, but your soul will be sold to the devil in the process. I'm just telling you. Make billions and be very, very unhappy, I guess.
When we made CityDesk and I would tell people that it was a content management system, it was desktop content management, a lot of people thought that it was document management, which is like you scan in all your contracts and you all have them instead of it's like an electronic version of a file cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they thought that was. And it turns out that there was actually this little industry called content management that were making products like that. And for most of us on the web, we thought it was like a web content management system that manages the content for a website. But some people got it confused with asset management, and it's just real hard when you try to do the generic things, and you can do all of the verticals into separately if you really want to. But then the next question becomes, how do you even market to those people? And so the reason that we don't try to make a system for building managers is we have no idea how to reach them. We do know how to reach software developers because they're already our audience. And right. So, I've long since learned not to try to fight that. I'm not going to make a product for web designers or, whatever. I can make a product for software developers and they will. That they're listening, they're reading my blog, and they're listening to this podcast, and they'll do it.
I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with this hosted version because I don't think you have that tight control of the audience anymore.
No, but true. I still think what we're going to get is sort of software-y
things.
Yeah, none of those people who are making macrame on Etsy are ever going to install this themselves. They might have a programmer who they get to do it.
Okay. Well, before we finish up, that was a great discussion, by the way. I enjoyed that question, so thank you for sending that one in.
Yeah.
I did want to cover one particular Stack Overflow question that's really a cool one, and maybe I'll just give the link. It's called Twitter Image Encoding Challenge, and it's 891643, and this is by Brian Campbell. And this is a really neat question that Brian set up. He basically set up a little contest, and I'll give you sort of the Reader's Digest version.
Whoa.
In 140 characters, how much of an image can you encode in any encoding method you want? You have 140 characters. Yep. Come up with the best possible image encoding for, say, the Mona Lisa. And he's got a really nice format. He's got the images. This is a really nice post, and I think it captured a lot of the imaginations of at least some people.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fun. So we probably don't need to go into too much detail on the podcast because we're kind of at the end.
Some of these are pretty good. Look at,
yeah, it's really fun. It's a perfect programmery thing. It's awesome. So,
all right, let's vote up.
Yeah, check Twitter it out. It has 183 upvotes and 165 stars, so it's obviously a popular question.
Yeah, so they're allowing he's allowing Unicode here, which gets you 2 bytes, and which doubles your bytes. So you get really 280 mm-hmm. bytes, more or less.
Yeah, it's a fun one. I encourage everybody to check it out.
Cool.
Well, Joel, you want to send us out?
Yes, I'm gonna send us out with. Let's see if I can figure this out. Somebody, what was it that you told me to do, and I went there and I found a picture of a Mexican boxer.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
The
oh
website,
yeah. Oh gosh, GordoFufas.net.
Yeah, yeah. What was I trying to do when I got to Gordo.Fufas?
We were looking at it, pool.ntp.org, and you happened to get that one time server and. Guys have emailed me, and actually he found Gordo, whoever it is. I can't quite tell what's going on.
I can't either, but they made a song for us,
and they have all these utilities, and they're totally into it. It's very, very fun.
Which I will play us out with the song. But until that happens, if you have any questions that you'd like to hear us answer in a future podcast episode, please call the Stack Overflow podcast hotline. The number is 646-826-3879. That's in the United States, of course. And also, you can record an MP3 or Ogg Vorbis, file an email to questions. No, stop. Email it to podcast@stackoverflow.com. That's podcast@stackoverflow.com. Try to keep it under 90 seconds or less. Please tell us how to spell your name, right? There's a transcript wiki wherein people type the transcripts of the parts that they like of this podcast, and if everybody types a little bit, then the whole thing gets recorded for the benefit of the hearing impaired. That will be linked to from the show notes, which are as always at blog.stackoverflow.com. See you next week.
See you next week.
This one goes out to all the former Daily Axe using the network time protocol. I got your NTP, baby. I got your back, brother.
So we want to pick an NTP server that's more off the beaten trail.
This is redirecting you to a website called Gordo.Fufas.net, and it's got a picture of a Mexican boxer.
You're lying. Pool.ntp.org project is a virtual cluster of time servers.
I guess meaningful.
Oh, no, maniac.
Am I under attack?
Yes.
This is redirecting me to a website called Gordo.Fufas.net, and it's got a picture of a Mexican boxer.
That was just an annoyance, but that's a good one.
Am I under attack?
Yes.
Oh, no, maniac.
I'm not trying to type it.
Oh, no, maniac.
us.pool.ntp.org. Am I under attack?
Yes. You're lying.
Gordo.pool.net. This is redirecting me to a website called Gordo.Fufas.net, and it's got a picture of a Mexican boxer.
You're lying. So you want to pick an NTP server that's more off the beaten trail.
Oh, no, baby,
yeah. Seriously.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
This one goes out to all the Gordo baby.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
us.pool.ntp.org. This is redirecting me to a website called Gordo.Fufas.net, and it's got a picture of a Mexican boxer. Straight down the drain.
That was just an annoyance, but that's a good one.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.